Appreciate so very much the invitation to come to be with you. I'm delighted to be here. It's been a joy to be here during the course of the week and to enjoy sitting at the feet of these great men as they're preaching and teaching things that have come forth from God's Word on such a wonderful subject as this. I want to take opportunity for just a second to express my appreciation to the congregation as a whole here, for the elders as well, for and Brother Tommy and all of them that are responsible for having put this together. But there is a number of people in the congregation, I'm sure Brother Tommy and the rest of them will, I would imagine, make note of them in a little while. But from the standpoint of those of us that are speakers and coming in, the things that you do to make us welcome means a great deal to us. The fact that you have provided the foods and the accommodations and things of this nature, a lot of these folks that are responsible for all this don't get the accolades that they perhaps need to, especially from us. But I think I can speak for the rest of the speakers as well that we certainly do appreciate everything that you folks have done to make our stay here welcome, and we appreciate your kind ears and attention to the things that we have provided as well. As I stated, it's been a wonderful week. It's been a wonderful subject, hasn't it? It's been good to be in here. Love is an endearing subject to us. There are a number of other subjects that fit along, coincide, I think, with it. Perhaps maybe peace, joy, long-suffering, mercy. You can think of any number of things like that that are very warming to our heart and endearing to us, even certain things, the church, the home. Things like this that warm our hearts in a number of different ways and encourage us and strengthen us. And as we continue to learn, I think, a great deal more about these particular issues that have to do with these matters, such as what we're talking about this week when we're talking about love. But as endearing as it is, and in the ways in which we might express it and the manifestations that we make of it, I think on most occasions is quite noble. I think most every one of us in our expressions and our manifestations of love have the scriptures at heart and wanting to do exactly what it is that God wants us to do in the expressions of it. Nevertheless, there are those that do have some warped views concerning love, and then some a bit apocryphal, hypocritical rather. I mean, you think of it in this particular fashion, and when you go back a little bit in history, maybe back in the 60s, early 70s, there was a particular philosophy that came out at that particular point in time. It's not a new one. The idea that was framed around the new morality, it goes all the way back even the time of the ancients. But nevertheless, there were one of the main tenets of love that was part of the new morality was the kind of love that seeks the highest good of self. And you might remember that. If in fact what it was, or if to illustrate it, if there was something that you might have had that I wanted and then loved serving myself, I'd just go take it from you because that just simply made it right in their estimation. You can elevate it just a little bit from some of the other warped views of love. There's a love that's called narcissism, which is an exaggerated admiration of oneself. Now, a little bit of the history about that, if I don't get this correct, then you can correct me, but I'm trying to remember it just off the top of my head right here. But narcissism, if I recall, it goes back in somewhat in Greek mythology, where a fellow by the name of Narcissus happens to look down at his image in a still pool of water, and he becomes so enamored with the visage of himself, he's not willing to leave the visage, and he dies of starvation where he was. And as a consequence of this, as the legend states, the flower Narcissus, which we know today, is something that has its name from that particular incident. The exaggerated admiration of oneself. And then you can take it a step further. There are those that apply only the concepts of love as is expressed by the Greek language, the eros, and that is the erotic or the sensual. But when we go back to what it is that we're talking about here, ladies and gentlemen, as our study is going to center around some of the statements that are found in 1 John chapter 3, obviously, then what we're seeing is that which is the love that is seeks the highest good of the other, because that's exactly what it is that God has extended toward us and the way that he has done it. A little bit of background as far as the book of 1 John is concerned, and I think most of us are familiar with this as well. John, of course, the writer of the letter, has either a real or perceived problem that he has, he sees and needs to be addressed. He, having been one responsible for having taught these people that are the recipients of this letter, he has a vested interest in their spiritual well-being. But there is a philosophy that has now pervaded this group of Christians, and to such an extent that it's causing their faith to wane or altogether be lost. The concept of Gnosticism, there were different forms of Gnosticism, but in general terms, it was denying the deity of Christ. And the particular one that he's addressing is having to do with the idea that Gnostics have the concept that that which was deity could not dwell in literal flesh. That was a repugnant concept to them. And now what it is that John is doing is addressing that. Now, this is a natural situation when you think about it. If there is the case that John has brought the gospel to these people, there are going to be those that are going to continue to adhere to it. You have to, I think, imagine that that would be the case, that there would be those that would remain dedicated to the truth, while there are those that are teetering on the edge of it because they are giving some plausibility to this philosophy of Gnosticism. Well, naturally, if there's going to be any conversation between these two, it could, in fact, cause some animosity. Now, with that in mind, you also bear into thought that it's a rather difficult thing for those that are in the world to actually acknowledge not only the existence of God, but why it is that we would have some dedication to a being that we cannot even see. Now, these very same people that have this particular, hold this particular position, those among atheists and some among the agnostics, they read their Bibles. They have copies of them and they read them. And one of the reasons why they do, of course, is for nefarious purposes, because what they're intending to do is find discrepancies within the scriptures to try to undermine what it states. But they know enough about it to know that those that claim to be disciples of Christ, as to what the scriptures teach, that they, how they ought to behave themselves and how they should conduct themselves. And when they see something in Christians that is inconsistent with that, they see that it's hypocritical, and therefore they have a diminished view of Christianity altogether. And so if they see Christians at each other's throat, then that's going to diminish their view of it, and they're not going to give it any plausibility whatsoever. Not only among those who are Christians, but it's also the fact that if they fail to see us as children of God who claim to be lovers of humankind, and we're not going to show compassion to those that are in the world as well, they're going to have a continued diminished view of it too. They may know very well the statements found in Galatians 6 and 10, as you therefore have opportunity, do good to all men, especially them of the household of faith. So we're not following that. Then they are going to use that as a means to undercut the concept of Christianity, if it so can be done. What the Apostle John is expressing here, as you're going to see in this particular text that we're undertaking in 1 John chapter 3, is that the child of God, to just express his love is one thing, as we have talked about during the course of the week. But it's something that has to be manifested. It has to be demonstrated. And that's what we want to take the opportunity to try to examine for a few moments this afternoon. Now, what we're going to be trying to do, ladies and gentlemen, is bring to us a basic exposition, I guess you might say, of 1 John chapter 3. But we're primarily going to be focusing on what we find in verses 11 through 21. We're here. Remember, the Apostle John states this. This is a message that you have heard from the beginning. We should love one another, not as Cain. Not as Cain, who was of that wicked one, and slew his brother. Wherefore slew he him? Because his own deeds were evil, and his brother's righteous. Marvel not, my brethren, if the world hate you. We know that we have passed from death into life because we love the brethren. Hereby, that's how we know and perceive exactly how it is that we ought to conduct ourselves. And so as you go through the text, he's telling us we know that we pass from death to the life because we love the brethren. He that loves not his brother abideth in the death. And whoso hateth his brother is a murderer. And you know that no murderer hath eternal life abiding in him. And so furthermore, he states this, hereby we perceive the love of God. Here's how our perception is made. Because he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our life for the brethren. For whoso hath this world's good and seeth his brother hath need, and shutteth up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwelleth the love of God in him? My little children, let us not love in word, neither in tongue, but in deed and in truth. And hereby we know we're of the truth, and shall assure our hearts before him. For if our heart condemn us, God is greater than our hearts and knoweth all things. Beloved, if our heart condemn us not, then we have confidence before God. Now, what we intend to try to establish, ladies and gentlemen, is we're going to look at a method, first of all, that John is going to use. We've talked about that during the course of the week as well. One of the marvelous ways that the Bible instructs is by the use of comparatives. Jesus was a master of it, and John's going to employ the very same thing. And so in order to be able to make his point, he's going to draw comparisons within this particular text as well. And then in the same process, what we want to try to do as well is look at some of the other things that he associates with love in this particular text and how they're all tied together. And then if time permits, that we might be able to look at the end result of our employing these particular admonitions and what that might result as far as our eternal destiny is concerned. But I want you to look as he begins the comparisons. Let's go back up into verse 1 of chapter 3. Behold, what manner of love God has bestowed upon us that we should be called sons of God. Now, there's a few words here I want you to note to start with. There's going to be two words and then a phrase. I want you to note, first of all, the word behold. I want you to note the term bestowed, and then we're going to look at the phrase, the manner of love. If you note, first of all, and he tells them to behold something, there is something here that you might be able to perceive. It should be easy for you to perceive. Now, put this in a little bit of perspective, ladies and gentlemen. Love is not a substance which we can go out here and touch. It's not like we could pick up the bottle right here. It is an emotion that is going to be manifested by those who have the capacity to illustrate it themselves. God has done so. And he's telling us here, the Apostle John is telling us, this is something that we ourselves can do. But I want you to first of all note, this is something that you can see. You can see the evidences of it. Now these people that have been affected by this philosophy that he has noted right here, on the basis of the fact that, or the notion that Jesus did not come in flesh, or that which is divine could not dwell in flesh, he deals with that in chapter 1. He presented his case concerning Christ, that which was from the beginning, which we have seen and heard, that which we have looked upon, and our hands have handled of the word of life. For the life was manifested, and we have seen it, and bear witness, and show unto you that eternal life which was with the Father, and was manifested unto us. It's something that has been seen. Think about the things that he had seen and heard. Perhaps he was with Jesus when he went to the house of Jairus over his dead daughter. What would he have heard? Talitha kumi, damsel arise. What did he see? Damsel arose. He might have been with Jesus in Bethany at the tomb of his friend Lazarus. And he might have heard the same words from Jesus saying, Lazarus, come forth. What would he see? Lazarus, come forth. No one could have the capacity to do that, even as Nicodemus also acknowledged, unless God be with him. There has to be something that is there that is in response to that which is divine, has to be divine. That's the case that he was making. Now, this love that he's expressing, is he telling them that this very same one that has the capacity to do these things came in the flesh to die for your redemption? That's an expression of God's love for you. Now, and it's also the case that we have to emulate that. But now notice, this is something that you can behold. This love has been bestowed on you. Didymi, that is, has been granted, has been given unto you. Not only the hope of the salvation, there's also been the imparting of spiritual gifts. These are things that would really be manifest to the each and every one of them. You know that that's the case. But now then, I want you to look what has been manifest. Behold what manner of love. Now, during the course of our discussion this week, yesterday, there was a great deal of attention that was given to John 3:16, where you're talking about the degree of God's love. God so loved. Well, this evening, Brother Hickson is going to give us his treatise on the matter of greater love, and no man than this, and a man lay down his life for his friends. And there you're talking about that which is also been exhibited by the gift of God himself, or the gift of the Son by God. There is no greater love. That extension of it, that degree of it, is something that's clearly demonstrated. We talked about in Romans chapter 8, the dimensions. You talk about there's no height nor depth. You could add the other dimensions, width, circumference, whatever it is that you want to do as far as the dimensions are concerned. The love of God is that which is immeasurable. It is such that our minds cannot comprehend it. But now look at what he's doing here. You got another word. You've seen the degree. You've seen the dimensions. Now you see the manner. The word manner, patapos, that which has to do with fineness. And as Thayer proclaims that it is a term that is describing the quality of excellence. You know, when you go buy something, especially if you're going to put out your hard-earned money for something that might be rather expensive, you're looking for quality, are you not? You don't want to have to put your money into something and it tear up before you get home. You kind of like to look for something that's going to be of quality. Well, this is the very thing that John's describing here, this comparisons as far as we might make with other things. Here is a love that is the finest of quality. Now watch the comparison. When we think about the love of God, the finest of quality, now how does ours measure? It's rather stark, isn't it? Now, many of us make the effort to emulate the love of God, and in our best efforts, many occasions, we even fail. We come short. At best, we might describe the love of man as being somewhat fickle. Sometimes it is expressed out of convenience. Other occasions, it might be expressed out of mutuality. That's the very thing the Lord was talking about. It's also been talked about this week in Matthew 5. Remember, he talked about if you love only those that love you, what reward do you have? What honor is it in that? But publicans do that. And there was a point to have noted concerning the publicans, because these were people that were hated. You know that from your study of the Bible. They were hated among the Jews because they were considered as agents of Rome. Most of them were extortioners and thieves, and so they despised them. So that offered the force behind his point. If you only love those that love you, you're not even better than they are. But we need to be careful about the standard of those that we use as our example. You know, Paul talked about that in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, that there were those that compare themselves among themselves and not wise. So we need to use the proper standard of our comparison, and who is that going to be? So that's the reason why there is this emphasis here. You're seeing in verses 2 and 3 as well, when he mentions, beloved, now are we the sons of God, and doth not yet appear what we shall be, but know when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is, and every man that hath this hope in him purifieth himself even as he is pure. Now you get an emphasis upon the hope that we have. Tell me a little bit about that. How is our hope realized? When would it be realized? If we have a hope to go to heaven, it's going to be based on what we're talking about here. John would be suggesting is only if we are like him. Now, I know he's talking about in the text that which is in reference to his eternal nature, his glorious nature, when he returns. But I'm looking at it in a different form. We have got to love like him. If we don't love like him, we are not like him. If we're not loving like him and not loving our brethren, he tells us we abide in death. That means we're in sin. Bottom line. And he notices in the text, even the one, as Brother Willie pointed out a little bit earlier, he that hates his brother is a murderer. And then ye know that no murderer hath eternal life abiding in him. He has pointed out very clearly the serious nature of this particular issue. So, he draws a comparison here. Here's another comparison I want you to see. Go back again and note verse 11. This is the message you've heard from the beginning. We should love one another, not as Cain. There's your comparison. Now, what was Cain's disposition? Well, he hated his brother. Somebody says, well, the text doesn't say he hates his brother. Yes, it does. It does by implication. That's what's stated in verse 11. He tells us we ought to love one another, not as Cain. Easy to perceive, is it not? He hated his brother. Now then, I want you to take that statement from verse 12, and I want you to compare it with what you see in verse 18. Look down in verse 18, which is the text of our consideration today. My little children, let us not love in word, neither in tongue, but in deed and in truth. Now let's make the comparison here. Go back and look at Cain. Now you've probably done this before, but I'm going to bring it to your attention again. Let's think about the circumstances with Cain. Did Cain hate in word only? No, he didn't. Cain hated in deed, and he manifested his deed when he took the life of his brother and affirmed the fact that he was not in truth. What was the issue he's having to deal with? Having to do with the sacrifices and his unwillingness to abide by the Lord's command regarding the sacrifice. And he proved the fact that he was not willing to abide by that and carried out that envy to the point where now he has murdered his brother. And the force of that illustration is that which provides the force of John's point. We cannot be like him. There is that strong correlation. Well, he carries it on just a little bit further as well. Hereby perceive we the love of God, because he laid down his life for us. All right, obviously the allusion to Jesus and the sacrifice. So then, the comparison. The following of this. We ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. Thayer tells us the idea behind that is his goodwill is due to him. We ought to lay down our life for the brethren. Now, he's not telling us that the child of God ought to persistently put his life in perilous situations for no reason. But when it is the case that the fellow child of God finds himself in need, in a perilous situation, or maybe needing our support because he's going through persecution as is his result of standing up for righteousness' sake, then we might need to be of the mindset to sacrifice our time, our money, our sleep, our food, and perhaps if the circumstance ever arose, maybe even our life, for one who shares a common love with us. Now that's a difficult thing for us to comprehend. Nevertheless, that's what he's encouraged. We ought, that his good will is due to him. We ought to lay down our life for the brethren. But now in all of this, it carries it over now to verse 17, because now what we're going to see here are some of the things that are involved in what he's talking about, how that we might be able to express and demonstrate this love. For whoso hath this world's good and seeth his brother have need and shutteth up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwelleth the love of God in him? Now, in noticing this text, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to note we're going to emphasize something that's found in the concept of compassion here. Now, the word compassion is not really in the original right here, but it's implied by the definition of the term bowels. The term bowels here from splagnon is that which is derivative of this, is spleen, which is where we get our word spleen. Well, this is something interesting right here. The ancients had different ways in which they would express their devotion or love. They would use different parts of the body to express. Some of the anxious would refer to love from the bosom and the concept of the heart being here. But now, many of them had the use, and this is where this is tying together with this language here, and it's the reason I think John is using it, and that's the reason why as well I think the translators of the King James here would use this terminology. The fact that love is something in their estimation stems from the lower portion of our thorax. Let me give you an idea as to why that relates. This term, incidentally, according to some of the scholars, has the idea that it sends forth the idea of sympathy and pity. And you think of it like this. In fact, a matter is that some of those among the anxious, the term relates to the more violent passions, and that like is what I understand is having to do with not only anger, but also love. And so I want you to consider it like this. If you ever get some bad news, and I'm talking about bad news, where do you normally feel it? Tommy, you ever get that knot in your stomach? You understand what I'm talking about? A lot of you men, you know, when you were young and that beautiful young lady came in your proximity, and that we talk about and still do on occasion, the butterflies in the stomach. Some of you married those gals, didn't you? The butterflies better still be there. Well, that's where it stems. That's the reason why the ancients thought of it that way. That's the reason for the terminology. In fact, Thayer even adds it to this. It says, the bowels were regarded by the Jews as the seat of the tenderer affections, such as kindness, benevolence, and compassion, such is the reason why that's employed in that particular text. Now, compassion, ladies and gentlemen, is not something that it doesn't know status. Some people might have the idea that those that have exclusive rights to compassion are those that are wealthy, because they're the only ones that have the capacity to be able to help those that are in need. That's not the case at all. It may involve monetary things, but that's obviously not all of it. There are other things that are involved in compassion. It could be sympathy, as is noted by the terminology. Sometimes some of the greatest wealth of help that you could provide is a sympathetic shoulder to lean on. I doubt very seriously if there's any person in this room that has not suffered a loss in the family. But, and on the basis of the fact that you have, when there's someone else that does, you're able to offer your sympathy to them because you felt that. Now, I'm in a little bit of a unique situation in that respect. My parents did not die by natural means, and they did not die in an accident. My parents were murdered. March 24th, 2011. I found them the next day. Now, what that does provide for me is an opportunity to deal with others that have experienced a similar situation. And I've been able to do that. And with those that I know that also had murders in their family, I've been able to sit down with them and we could share notes and we talk with one another, and it helps for all of us to be able to talk about things of that nature. If I didn't care one way or the other, I wouldn't do it. But that's one of the ways I try to exhibit my compassion for others. It may be just a simple thing as pains. You know, I remember a good long time ago, I'd hear people talk about having sciatica pain. I couldn't relate to it. Oh, I can now. Ooh, yeah. I can. And when anybody talks about it, I know exactly what they're talking about. I don't have it now. I finally got over it. But I'm telling you, that's something you can sympathize with people over that. But now when you look at what it is that John's talking about here, he's specified a particular area that has to do with the matter of this expression of love and compassion. If you see somebody that has this world's goods and you shut up your bowels from him, the compassion from him, then he offers this particular question: how dwelleth the love of God in him? I want to break down that passage just a second. Verse 17. If you're writing down anything, you can break it down with four P's. Help you to remember some things that are found in this text. Number one is the possessors. Whoso hath this world's good, he's the possessor of the goods. Number two, his perception. This person that is the possessor perceives by virtue of seeing his brother has need. Number three, there is the preclusion. Because this person who is the possessor and sees his brother has need has precluded that he doesn't need to see to the brother's need and fails to do so. Number four is perdition, which is set up by the question, how dwelleth the love of God in him? What's the answer? He doesn't. If he doesn't have that in him, he's already pointed out, as you've seen, he's abiding in death. He's a murderer, essentially. That is his fate. Now, what's the alternative? That's what you see in verse 18. The admonition, my little children, let us not love in word, as it's been expressed earlier, not in word only, neither in tongue only, but in deed and in truth. Now, if we put that to practice, what can come of that? You know, when John makes this admonition, one of the interesting things about the book of 1 John is the use of the first person plural throughout the book. He doesn't say I, it's we, us, and our. So he's including himself in the admonitions. And it's evidently the case that when you look at what John is telling them here, he's evidently practiced this. Therefore, he is using himself as an example for them. He's not going to point out something to them that they should do he hadn't done himself or not willing to do so. Then, having now tied thus far, what we have seen is the concept of benevolence that's seen in verse 17 and also with that compassion. But I want to go to another text real quick, which has also been noted this week. But I want to use it in this context as well, and that's in James, the second chapter, because he's going to bring to knowledge to us the fact that it's not only involving the matter of benevolence, not only the matter of compassion, but then there is the matter of faith. When you go to James chapter 1 and verse 27, pure religion and undefiled before the God and the Father is this, that you visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction. Now, every one of us in here that are Bible students know that the term visit is not you just go see them, you see to their need. Now then, when he brings the illustration down at verse 15, if a brother or sister be naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you say unto them, depart in peace. Be ye warmed and filled. Notwithstanding, you give them not those things which are needful to the body. What doth it profit? Even so, faith without works is dead being alone. Now you compare that with what you saw in 1 John 3:17, 18. You see the correlation? So if we're going to claim, ladies and gentlemen, to be people of love and people of faith, look at those things. Benevolence, compassion, faith, and they're all tied together with that wonderful little principle we've been talking about this week. You remember Galatians chapter 5, verse 6, where Paul had stated here, circumcision doesn't avail anything, uncircumcision, but what? Faith, you tell it, say it with me. Faith, which does what? Works by love. Faith, which works by love. So you've got all those particular principles that are tied together with this marvelous element that he's given right here. If those things are going to work, ladies and gentlemen, it has to use the love that he's talking about here. If that is done, ladies and gentlemen, then there is a confidence. I want you to turn with me. We're going to read a section together. We're going to go to the book of Job before we close. The book of Job. Now we remember what happened to Job in the first section. Job was a righteous man, wasn't he? In fact, so much so that God held him up in high esteem and even brought it to Satan's attention. I would have loved to have witnessed that. That would have been a wonderful thing. Have you considered my servant Job? Well, I mean, you know. Reason he's the way he is, because you've given him everything he's got. You take that away from him, he'll turn against you. I tell you what, you try it and let's see what happens. So, takes his children, takes his wealth, takes his crops, all of that. Loses it all. He still doesn't turn. The next meeting, you see what I told you? He didn't turn. Well, you've hedged all around about him. But I tell you what, you take his health and he'll curse you. Do whatever you want, you just can't kill him. So he afflicts him physically. The Bible speaks of it as boils. I'm not certain if that's exactly the concept, the word. Maybe. But one of the things that I have learned from that, when his three friends come to see him, he's got pottery sherds and he's scraping himself. You remember that? You don't do that to boils. You do it with a pox, because a pox itches. You can get used to a little bit of pain, but I want to tell you something. If there's anything that'll drive you crazy, is a constant itch. And I've got a feeling that's probably more about what it is that he had. I can't say that for certain, but I just have the concept that that might be what it is. Anyway, after all he's lost, he's got his friends that come to see him, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. I call them Moe, Larry, and Curly of the Old Testament. In my estimation, after their efforts of trying to convince him that he's done so much wrong, it turns basically into a circus a bit. Now, I know Job is trying to figure out what it is that's going on with him, but these three fellows are trying to point out different things that must be responsible for his problem, and Job is going to resist all of that. He's going to retract it all. And it may be so far, round about verse chapter 20, that gives them the idea, well, perhaps there may be some things that you haven't done. Perhaps you hadn't cared for the poor or anything like that. Well, I want you to turn to chapter 29. I've got a reason for this. I want you to look at verses 12 and 13 and 15 and 16. And I want you to notice how Job reacts to such a charge like this. Verse 12, he states this, "Because I delivered the poor that cried, I heard their moanings, I heard their lament, and I delivered them." What about the fatherless? "I heard their cries as well." What did he say about it? "I have delivered them and him that had none to help him. I've done that as well. The blessing of him that was ready to perish." There were people on the verge of death and I brought them back because of the help. It came upon me. And whatever it was that was the problem with the widow, she had lost her husband. She didn't know what it was that she was going to do. But I made her heart sing. I provided for her needs. Look at verses 15 and 16. "I was eyes to the blind. I was feet to the lame. And father to the poor." And even those that had a cause, whatever the cause was that was creating their problems, I researched it, found it out, and I rectified the problem. Point. Job did not love in word only, did he? He put what things he had on the line, and he had sufficient to do it, and did it. And that's the very thing that the Apostle John is trying to get across to us. You know, I mentioned in prayer the other day, number of those folks that are suffering in North Carolina and East Tennessee. I have had contact with many of these people up in that area, and I'm telling you, what you see doesn't even compare to the way it is. We're helping. I've got some friends of mine that are going up there as well to try to do what they can do to assist. There are Christians that are fulfilling what it is that John is telling us. I'll just simply close it with this. When we consider John's statement here, you know, my friends, to talk of love is one thing. But to demonstrate, it's altogether something else.